What is going on, everybody? Welcome back for episode 2 of the Royal Hour. I, of course, am your host, Joseph Royal. And man, it's been a week. It has been a hell of a week in the sports world. And we are going to get into anything and everything involving that. NFL news, NFL week 4 review, some things on my mind that don't necessarily have anything to do with sports, but most importantly, as you can see from the thumbnail, if you're watching on YouTube, we are going to get into the Mr. McMahon documentary. So before we get into anything else, please like, share, and subscribe. Share this with as many people as possible. Want to get this out to as many people as possible. I love the support that we got in episode one, and I want to just keep that going. So by all means, please get this out to as many people as you possibly can. I really appreciate it. With that being said, let's get into week 4 of the NFL season. It's been, I don't know, man. Week four was kind of meh to me, I guess the word would be. I expected some of these games to be boring, but man, this entire week was just boring. We'll get into it. You know, let's start with the Thursday game. The Cowboys took that 20-15 in New York against the Giants. Very boring game. The Cowboys did not look impressive in this game at all. Dak 22-27, 221, 2 touchdowns, no picks. They kept him relatively clean. He only got sacked once, but you know, Dallas just, there's something about them that is missing right now, and I don't know exactly what it is. I can't put my finger on it as far as what they are missing. I'm pretty sure it's what we talked about last week, which is a true starting running back. But I mean, even with the passing game, you know, they did play against the Giants, who are putrid. So Dak only had 5 incompletions, but just in general, they're, I don't know. Dallas isn't very impressive to me right now. Rico Dowdle had 11 carries for 46 yards. Zeke had 5 for 19. Just a very meh game. You know, CD had 7 for 98 and a touchdown. But overall, this game was pretty boring to watch, in my opinion. Daniel Jones threw the ball 40 times. 29 for 40, 281. No touchdowns, a pick. 281 for him is actually pretty impressive. They kept him relatively clean too. He only got sacked once, but that's kind of the thing. It's like, you know, if you keep, usually if you can keep the two, or if you can keep two of the better quarterbacks in the league clean, right, which Daniel Jones doesn't fit in that category, but in a given week, if you had Dak Prescott and, you know, Justin Herbert, or Dak Prescott and Patrick Mahomes, if they each only got sacked once, you're looking at at least 30 points on both sides, right? So this game was just very meh. You know, Malik Nabers played very well. We know he's a budding star. We talked about that last week. 12 catches for 115 yards. But overall, just a very meh game. Especially for a highlighted, you know, Thursday night game. It just was very unremarkable. Let's move on to the Sunday games. The Broncos took this one against the Jets 10-9 in New York, or I guess New Jersey. Not going to get into that whole thing. I was disappointed in the Jets offense. I was very disappointed in the Jets offense. They, after the past few weeks where they've looked really good, seemed like they were starting to gel. This week in particular, I mean, granted, they haven't been setting the world on fire, but to only put up 9 points at home, and those are all field goals against a team like Denver, it's not good. It's not good. I'm not going to hit the panic button on them yet, but this was a game where the Jets should have really started to find their stride. So Aaron Rodgers, 24 for 42, 225. That's just, he threw the ball 42 times and only had 225 yards. A lot of dink and dunking, not throwing the ball down the field that much. He got sacked 5 times, which is a huge problem. Breece Hall, 10 carries for 4 yards. You know, Denver's defense really stepped up and said, you guys are not going to be able to run the ball on us today. And they couldn't. They couldn't run the ball. They started getting in the third and longs. They were get after Aaron Rodgers, and there was nobody open downfield. There was nobody to break open, you know, in a broken play situation where he breaks out of the pocket. It just was a very bad game as far as the play calling, a very bad game as far as the offensive line is concerned. And the Jets looked putrid offensively. And I saw it at the start of the game. They had like 3 or 4 penalties in a row. It was bad. They got backed up to their goal line. There were a couple times in that game where they started their drives on like their goal line or near their goal line. Very, very undisciplined in that game. And, you know, yeah, the defense played well. They only held Denver to 10, but you lost. So that's really a moot point. Bo Nix, 12 for 25, 60 yards. Yes, you heard that correctly. He had 60 yards, and they won this game. 60 yards passing and a touchdown. They won this game. He didn't get sacked. Javonte Williams, 16 for 77 yards. Nothing really to see here. Cortland Sutton had a couple of huge plays, 3 catches for 60 yards and a touchdown, but like I said, this is going to be a trend with week 4 as you go along. Just not a very good week of football. The 49ers and the Patriots. Not much to see here. Pretty much paint-by-numbers stuff. San Fran is healthy again, so they played pretty well. Patriots are a rebuilding team, and you can kind of see that. Not kind of see that. It's actually glaringly visible for everybody to see. You know, Jacoby Brissett, 19 for 32, 168 yards, a touchdown and a pick. He was sacked 6 times. That line is awful. Ramondre Stevenson, 13 for 43. You know, the Niners held him in check pretty well. The leading receiver for the Patriots was Antonio Gibson, who is a running back. Their receivers are not good. They cannot create separation. They cannot win 50-50 battles with jump balls. None of that stuff is something you're going to see when you watch the Patriots. Meanwhile, Brock Purdy, 15 for 27, 288. He did throw a touchdown and also threw a pick. He was only sacked 1 time, so they kept him relatively clean. Jordan Mason, budding star in the league, 24 carries, 123 yards, and a touchdown. He's been playing really well during this absence of Christian McCaffrey, and I'm sure the 49ers are thankful that this kid has just hit the ground running. Juwan Jennings, 3 catches for 88 yards. Other than that, the passing game wasn't anything really to write home about. Kittle did have a touchdown. But yeah, like I said, paint-by-numbers stuff. Niners pretty much controlled the clock, held the offense of the Patriots in check, which isn't a surprise because most teams are going to do that this year. And yeah, the Niners are back to 2-2. I think they're going to go on a bit of a run now. Vikings and the Packers, nice little division battle here. The Vikings go to 4-0 in this one, taking it 31-29 against the Packers in a pretty close game, pretty competitive game. The Vikings dominated in the first half, and then the Packers made their way back, dropped 22 on the Vikings in the fourth quarter, but just was not enough. Jordan Addison was back for the Vikings this week, 3 catches for 72 yards. Jefferson had 6 for 85. Aaron Jones, 22 carries for 93 yards. Sam Darnold, 20 for 28, 275, 3 touchdowns and a pick. Only was sacked twice. Meanwhile, on the other side, Jordan Love, 32 for 54. He threw the ball way too much. 4 touchdowns, 3 picks. He was only sacked 1 time. Josh Jacobs, 9 carries, 51 yards. Not going to get it done. Jaden Reed, 7 catches, 139 yards, and a touchdown. They got plenty of offense in the second half. The Vikings just held on for the win in the end. Vikings looking pretty impressive right now at 4-0. Can't lie. Are they for real? We'll see. As their elevation of or I should say, as their level of competition elevates later in the season, we will see if they are for real or not. Right now, they look like it. And just to think they have J.J. McCarthy waiting in the wings is kind of crazy. So, definitely love this story going on right now with Sam Darnold. He's proven a lot of the doubters wrong. Saints and the Falcons. The Falcons took this one 26-24 at home. Another decent game. This pretty much ended with a buzzer-beater field goal from Younghoe Koo. Not Younghoe Koo, which a lot of people say because y'all are messy. But no, Younghoe Koo finished this one off with a 58-yard field goal. Ice in his veins to finish this game. Falcons go to 2-2, and they drop the Saints to 2-2, which kind of said I didn't think that the Saints were crashing down to earth, but they might be. They might be. Or maybe the Falcons are just that good. We don't know. It's too early in the season. Derek Carr, 28 for 36, 239, zero touchdowns, and a pick. He was only sacked one time. Man, a lot of these quarterbacks are kept relatively clean this week. Alvin Kamara, 19 for 77 and a touchdown. He also added seven catches for 42 yards. Chris Olave, 8 for 87. On the Falcons side, Kirk Cousins, 21 for 35. No touchdowns and a pick. I mean, he was also kept relatively clean. It was just a weird week, man. I'm trying to tell y'all. Bijan Robinson, 7 for 28. Tyler Algier, 8 for 60. Drake London, 6 catches, 64 yards. I don't know, man. This was a weird week. The Falcons took this one at home in a pretty well-played game defensively, honestly. But in the end, the Saints dropped a 2-2, which might be some cause for concern after the hot start that they had. But it's like I said also, you know, everybody's bounce-back game, everybody's statement game seems to come against the Cowboys and in Jerry's world. So you don't really know how much you can take from that sometimes. Moving on to the next game, the Eagles and the Buccaneers. Now, this is a game that I want to talk about because the Eagles should really start to worry. Eagles fans, which they already are. I'm going to get into Twitter a little bit later. Some of you fans are annoying as hell. The Eagles lost this one 33-16 in Tampa. Jalen Hurts, 18 for 30, a touchdown, no picks, sacked six times. Saquon Barkley, 10 for 84. He also added two catches for 32 yards. Dallas Goedert was their leading receiver, 7 for 62. Baker Mayfield, 30 for 47, two touchdowns and no picks, 347 yards. He balled out this game, even without much of a run game to show for it. You know, his leading rusher, it's funny actually, Bucky Irving and Rashad White both had 10 carries for exactly 49 yards. Mike Evans, 8 for 94. He's just steady, and honestly, I think I'm starting to be able to make a case that he's the most underrated receiver in the history of the league at this point. So yeah, let's talk about the Eagles. I'm really starting to notice a lot of holes in Sirianni's play calling, and I'm really starting to notice how bad this offensive line is going to be moving forward. Not even just how bad they are now. I don't know how much they can patch this up. Jason Kelce was the eyes and ears for everything as far as that offense was concerned, really, when it came down to pass protection. And he had obviously a great chemistry with Jalen Hurts. Getting this new center acclimated has been way harder than I think they expected it to be. And if they don't right this ship pretty soon, they're looking at being on the outside looking in this division, because the Commanders are playing really well. And the Cowboys, eventually you have to think they're going to go on some sort of run. Their season's not over. This is going to be a very competitive division. And outside of this division for the wild card, it's going to be very competitive to get into the playoffs if you don't win your division. Jalen Hurts did not turn the ball over this game, but turning the ball over for him has been an issue. This season has been a big issue. And like I said, protection. If you cannot protect your quarterback in this league, I don't care how many targets you have on outside. I don't care what targets you have coming out of the backfield. I don't care what kind of run game you think you have with Saquon Barkley. None of that is going to matter because you can't protect Jalen Hurts on third and manageable. You can't protect him on third and long. If you can't run the ball four downs in a row, then you're screwed. Because right now, you know, getting sacked six times in an NFL game is ridiculous for a team that is supposed to be one of those upper echelon teams. So there's definitely cause to pause, reason for concern as far as the Eagles are concerned. The next game was the Bengals and the Panthers. Bengals took this one 34-24 in Carolina. The Bengals viewed this as a must win. I think it was a pretty early must win for them. Burrow went 22 for 31, 232, two touchdowns and one pick. Chase Brown added 15 carries for 80 yards. Ja'Marr Chase, 3 for 85 and a touchdown. T. Higgins, 6 for 60. Just a very weird week, man. I don't know how to describe it. It's just very weird. Andy Dalton, 25 for 40, 220, two touchdowns and a pick. Chuba Hubbard, 18 for 104 and a touchdown. Deontay Johnson, 7 for 83. A lot of you folks that were trying to trash Bryce Young and thought that Andy Dalton was going to come and make this miracle run, yeah, no, it's not going to happen. They're still going to be a bottom four team. Moving on, another divisional game, Jaguars and the Texans. The Texans took this one at home, 24-20. C.J. Stroud threw a touchdown pass with just a little bit of time left to give the Texans the win in this divisional game. Trevor Lawrence, 18 for 33, 169, two touchdowns and no picks. Kept him relatively clean. He only got sacked once. Tank Bigsby, not even going to pretend to know who that is, had 7 carries for 90 yards. Travis Etienne only had 11 for 50. I don't know if he got hurt during this game or what. Brian Thomas Jr., 6 catches for 86 yards and a touchdown. Christian Kirk also added a touchdown, 7 catches and 61 yards. C.J. Stroud, 27 for 40, 345, two touchdowns and a pick, no picks. Just a stud, man. Just an absolute stud. Like I said last week, my favorite young quarterback in the league. Definitely a great bounce back week for him. Cam Akers, 13 for 53. That combination of him and Joe Mixon, whenever Joe Mixon comes back, is going to be great. Nico Collins, 12 catches, 451 yards. Another really nice young receiver. Stephon Diggs, 5 for 69. Dalton Schultz, 3 for 34. And the Texans take this divisional game at home. The Jaguars are putrid. They are way worse than they should be as far as an on-field product because on paper, they look like they should be competing for this division. And right now, they're 0-4. I don't know. It's kind of perplexing. Steelers and the Colts. Colts took this one at home 27-24. I know Anthony Richardson got hurt in this game. Joe Flacco came in and saved the day. But let's get into Justin Fields. 22 for 34. Pause, by the way. 22 for 34, 312, and a touchdown. No picks. Justin Fields also had 55 rushing yards and two touchdowns rushing. George Pickens, 7 for 113. I really hope eventually he puts it together and starts to really put himself up there with the top echelon receivers because he has all the talent to. He has all the talent to be up there with the best receivers in the league, in my opinion. Joe Flacco came in, 16 for 26, 168 yards, two touchdowns, and zero picks. He's one of those stay-ready-so-you-don't-have-to-get-ready type players. It's kind of crazy at this point in his life, at this point in his career, that he continues to play at a pretty high level when called upon to come in for one of the, you know, star quarterbacks that he's coming in for, which either it's Deshaun Watson, in this case, Anthony Richardson. Very impressive how he stays ready. Jonathan Taylor, 21 carries, for 88 yards and a touchdown. Michael Pittman, 6 catches, 413 yards. The Colts will be around towards the end of the season, in my opinion, in this division. I don't know if they'll win it. I think the Texans are still going to take this division. But, man, I like the Colts. I like the Colts. I think they're a nice young team. They obviously get this quarterback situation figured out, even when Anthony Richardson is healthy, as we talked about last week. He is a bit of a project. So they got to figure that out. But Jonathan Taylor is obviously going to be their bell cow running back, be able to, you know, carry this offense a lot of weeks. And Joe Flacco came in and played pretty steady. So if Anthony Richardson does miss a couple weeks, I don't think they need to worry about sliding in the division rankings. Next, we had the Rams and the Bears. The Bears pick up their second win of the season, rather, not first. Second win of the season. Caleb Williams played really well. 17 for 23, 157 touchdown, and no picks. For a rookie quarterback playing behind a line, it's pretty putrid. Caleb Williams played pretty well, pretty efficient, protected the ball. Can't really ask for much more at this point. DeAndre Swift, 16 carries for 93 yards and a touchdown. He also got a touchdown from their backup running back, Roshan Johnson, 7 for 26 and a touchdown. Bears played pretty well this game. Held this Rams offense in check. Matthew Stafford, 20 for 29, 224, no touchdowns and a pick. Kyren Williams, 19 carries for 94 yards. So they did have a pretty good day running the ball, but overall, the Bears did a pretty good job of holding them in check. You know, kept them under 500 as far as third down efficiency is concerned. The Bears were putrid on third down. But like I said, the Bears right now are just trying to figure out what kind of team they are. They have a lot of talent offensively, but that line is putrid, as I've been saying. And the play calling, once again, I just don't like certain things that they do play calling wise as far as down and distance calls they make. And I think they need to get Caleb Williams moving a bit more mobile, especially behind this terrible offensive line. The Commanders and the Cardinals. The Commanders beat the dog crap out of the Cardinals in this game. 42-14, the Commanders took this one on the road. Jaden Daniels continues to impress. 26 for 30, that's 4 incompletions, folks. 26 for 30, 233. He did throw a pick, but he threw a touchdown. Was not sacked this game. Brian Robinson, 21 carries for 101 yards and a touchdown. This Commanders team right now is scary. Defensively, they're really good. Offensively, they're finding their stride. Jaden Daniels seems like he is just primed for, you know, being up there with one of the best quarterbacks in the league in the next few years if he continues, you know, this level of play. Meanwhile, on the other side, Kyler Murray, 16 for 22, 142 yards, one touchdown, no picks. James Conner, 18 for 104, and a touchdown. The Cardinals are going to be a bottom four team. So I don't know where that leaves them. Obviously, we're looking at Travis Hunter being one of the top picks next year. I don't know, man. There are some pretty bad teams in the league. That's all I can say. Next game, the Browns and the Raiders. The Raiders took this one 20-16. Obviously, did not convince Davante Adams to want to stay. We'll get into that in a little bit. Yeah, so the Browns made a little bit of a comeback late, but the Raiders held them off 20-16, as I said. Deshaun Watson, 24 for 32, 176, touchdown and a pick. Was also sacked 3 times. Jerome Ford, 10 for 58. That is not going to get it done. I know they're just counting the seconds, minutes, and hours until, you know, Nick Chubb is back on the field. Jerry Jeudy, 6 for 72. Amari Cooper, 4 for 35. On the Raiders side, Gardner Minshew, 14 for 24, 130 yards, no touchdowns, no picks. Kept him relatively clean. He's only sacked twice. Alexander Mattison, 5 for 60, no touchdowns. Zamir White, 17 for 50, no touchdowns. Jacoby Myers, 5 for 49. Pretty much what you would expect from a Browns and Raiders game at this point in the season. We're going to get into the Raiders, like I said, in a little bit, but they seem like kind of a feisty team, a scrappy team that's going to hang around for perhaps a wild card spot on the last week of the season, or in the last week of the season, rather, but I don't think they're making the playoffs this year. They might fall somewhere around 500, maybe like 8-9. Chiefs and the Chargers, another game that disappointed me. The Chiefs took this one 17-10 in LA. I don't know. The Chiefs just find a way to win, man. Pat Mahomes, 19 for 29, 245, a touchdown, and a really bad pick that he threw. Kareem Hunt, 14 for 69. They're still playing without, what's his name? Isaiah Pacheco. So they're undefeated without their starting running back. Rashee Rice got injured in this game. They think he's avoided a torn ACL. He's going to be out for about 4 or 5 weeks, they're saying right now. I also think there's a suspension coming down for him, so that's another thing to monitor. Travis Kelce, with his first really good game of the season, 7 for 89. You know, the Chiefs just keep trucking along. As far as the Chargers, Justin Herbert, 16 for 27, 179 yards, one touchdown and no picks. J.K. Dobbins, 14 carries, 32 yards. The Chargers offense really needs to find its way right now. They are 2-2, but the quarterback whisperer really needs to figure out how to get this offense in motion, because while they don't have the targets that they used to, they have enough where they should be better than they are, especially considering they are keeping Justin Herbert relatively clean in the pocket. So the Chargers need to figure this out. Defensively, they have a lot of talent, and they should be at least vying for this division, but doesn't look like it's going to happen this year. The Sunday night game, the Ravens took this one 35-10. The Bills are just one of those teams that you never, like, you can never fully put your faith in them, because they'll have weeks like this where they completely just lay an egg. Derrick Henry rushed for almost 200 yards, 199, 24 carries and a touchdown. Lamar Jackson also had a touchdown rushing. He threw the ball 18 times, 13 for 18, 156 yards, two touchdowns, no picks. He was sacked one time, and I think it was on like a scramble or something. I am liking this Ravens team right now. Considering they beat one of the better teams in the league with Lamar Jackson only throwing the ball 18 times, that is super impressive. Super, super impressive. They can run the ball. It seems like when they want to pass the ball, they can pass the ball pretty well. As far as the Bills, Josh Allen, 16 for 29, 180 yards, did not have a touchdown pass this game. James Cook, 9 for 39. Khalil Shakir, 4 for 62, just could not get things going. I don't know whether this is a situation of the Bills not being for real or the Ravens definitely being for real, because we've seen the Ravens in the playoffs. They just can't seem to get that perfect balance of running the ball and passing the ball once the postseason comes. So I don't really know what to make of this game, but the Bills did get blown out in this one, 35-10, as I said. So this will be something to monitor in the next few weeks. Von Miller also is suspended, so there's that. They've already lost some pieces in the offseason defensively. I hope the Bills don't go on a slide here, but it might start to, I don't know, create somewhat of a snowball effect, because like I said, Von Miller out, you're losing a pass rusher, and offensively they did not look very good in this game. Let's move on to the Monday night games. The Titans took this one against the Dolphins in the doubleheader, first game of the doubleheader, 31-12. I am not going to pretend I watched this game, because I didn't. I had no interest in either one of these games. As I said, Tennessee took this one 31-12. The Dolphins look putrid without Tua Tagovailoa. I'll say that. Mason Rudolph came in because Will Levis got hurt. He went 9 for 17. 85 yards. This game, just looking at the score sheet, was absolute trash. Tony Pollard, 22 for 88 and a touchdown. DeAndre Hopkins was their leading receiver with two catches for 31 yards. Tyler Boyd also had two for 31. I try to tell you guys, it's a really weird week. Tyler Huntley, just signed by the Dolphins, came in as the starting quarterback, 14 for 22, 96 yards. He also was their leading rusher with eight carries for 40 yards. This game, I don't know, you can correct me in the comment section, please, by all means, seemed like it was trash, and I made the right decision by not watching it. The second game in the doubleheader was the Seahawks and the Lions. The Lions took this one 42-29 at home. This was a pretty good game. Jared Goff went perfect as you can go. He did not throw an incompletion. 18 for 18 for 292 yards, two touchdowns, no picks. He was sacked three times. St. Brown also threw a touchdown to him. Really clever trick play on the goal line. St. Brown put it right on him over the linebacker's head. The Lions are looking very impressive. As I said last week, I think they're going to go on a bit of a run. Jahmyr Gibbs, 14 carries for 78 yards. Montgomery, 12 for 40, including one of the more impressive runs of this early season. And I think as the season goes on, you're going to see that not many people can top that run. Running a guy over, cutting it back against the grain, beating everybody in a foot race to the edge, and finishing the run in the end. I mean, just very impressive physical football team, able to throw the ball. There's nothing the Lions don't have as far as qualities of a team that can make the Super Bowl. As for the Seahawks, they are also 3-1. They were undefeated coming into this game. Geno Smith threw the ball 56 times. 38 for 56, a touchdown and a pick, 395 yards. Kenneth Walker back this week, good to see that. 12 carries for 80 yards and three touchdowns. He had a really good game. DK, 7 for 104. Tyler Lockett, 5 for 61. Jackson Smith and Jigba, 8 for 51. Yeah, man, the Lions are just a better team right now. I think the Seahawks will be around in that division towards the end of the year. Obviously, I think the Niners are favored to win that division still, even despite their injury issues. But the Seahawks are a team that will be around, and I think they would definitely make the playoffs. That is my NFL review for the week. Let's talk about some NFL news. Devontae Adams. So I don't know if you recall last week, this is the second week that the Raiders are having their own separate segment. Because last week, Antonio Pierce decided he was going to call some guys out for their effort in that blowout loss. So now we find out that Devontae Adams is open to being traded. Pretty much flat out has said that he would prefer to be traded. Now, as a person who is a supporter of the Jets, because A-Rod's there, I'm not going to act like it's... I mean, I've liked the Jets in the past, but like I said, I watch a lot of football, so there are a lot of teams that I like. Because of the fact I'm a supporter of the Jets, I am giddy about this. Okay, his top two teams right now, his top two landing spots are the Saints and the Jets. And it's said that he is emphasizing, or rather putting more priority on teams with quarterbacks that he's played with before, Derek Carr and, of course, Aaron Rodgers. I'm also seeing now that the Cowboys are also in the mix. The Steelers are now also in the mix. And the thing that gets me is the Raiders are basically saying, you can have Devontae Adams for a second round pick. Do you guys wonder now, or do you guys see now, rather, why so many franchises are just putrid, losing franchises? A second round pick for an all-pro receiver. This might turn into a Randy Moss to the Patriots situation. It really might. Okay, the Jets are monitoring the situation. The Cowboys are monitoring the situation. The Steelers are looking like they might dip their toe in that water. If Devontae Adams gets traded for like a second pick, a second round pick, man, somebody got to get fired. Somebody got to get fired, man. Okay, Devontae Adams, I think it was yesterday, the day before that, also said that he has had no contact with anybody from the organization. Prior to this, of course, I guess he informed them that he wanted to be traded. But prior to that, he had no contact with anybody from the organization. Antonio Pierce wants to play hardball, and he's going to find himself in another defensive coordinator role quickly if he does not stop playing games. That's all I'm going to say. That's all I'm going to say about that one. Let's get into some things on my mind. things on my mind. Let's talk about, just really quickly, let's talk about Twitter. You know, I'm 31 years old. I don't know if I'm a boomer at this point for this take, but social media, and really Twitter mostly, primarily, is so unbearable sometimes. Twitter a lot of times, most times actually. If it's not fight pages putting these stupid fights up, it's stan pages. Literal stan pages of celebrities. Ariana Grande, Beyonce, Nicki Minaj, Taylor Swift. Then you have the sports ones. Blank Muse. Anybody's name. Anybody's name followed by Muse. Stan page. Joel Embiid Muse. Jason Tatum Muse. Just like, the site is so annoying to just scroll through sometimes. People saying stupid stuff, having dumb sports takes or dumb takes in general just on everyday life. Twitter has really, it's really suffered a decline since Elon Musk has taken over. Because, yeah, while you can say a lot of stuff and still not get banned, the fact that the For You section has turned into a complete cesspool, I mean, you're not going to make any friends on Twitter. Seeing the stupid stuff that I see, I'm not gonna co-mingle with these people. I mean, it's like, you know, you see these terrible dating takes or these depressed pages where they just talk about their, you know, depression and, oh my God, you know, you ever just wake up and sit in a dark room and think about all the bad decisions you made? No, I don't. I don't. Sorry. I don't have that in common with you. And then the worst part is you interact with one of those pages. And I don't even say interact. Like, you might click on it by mistake. You'll get 5-10 more. Twitter is terrible. You know, the stan pages, like I said, staying stupid stuff, whether it's a LeBron hate page or a Jordan hate page or a Jordan stan page or a LeBron stan page or a Kobe stan page. There are some guys that have, you know, wrestling stan pages or you know, it's a page with a female wrestler's picture, but it's like an 18-year-old boy. What? And all they post all day is stuff about that wrestler, and they knock any wrestler that they think is compared to them or has a higher position on the card. It's weird, bro. It's so weird. Like, I don't mean to get on a rant, but like, Twitter is just a cesspool, man. Worthless individuals. Just praising and praying to and worshiping false idols. Humans. And you see this crap and it's just like, it's so hard to just scroll past it because some stuff is just so weird and so stupid. I have to say something sometimes. And those stan pages, man, God, I wish they'd purge these damn stan pages. Like, the fight pages. Don't get me started on the political propaganda. I don't talk politics on this page. Never will. But the political pages on Twitter, the crap that pops up, unbearable. Pushing whatever agenda they're trying to get behind and get other people behind. Just ridiculous, man. And it's not even like it calms down after election time. No, it continues throughout the year. So that's my rant about Twitter. Let's get on to something positive. Have any of you guys watched the show The Anonymous? Man, I love that show, The Anonymous. So, if you don't know what The Anonymous is, it comes on every Monday after Monday Night Raw on the USA Network. It is a show where they basically bring people into this house. It's a reality show where they bring people into this house. I guess technically these two houses, but into this area where, you know, they live together for a certain amount of weeks, and they, the reason it's called The Anonymous is because they get into a room every day and they talk from behind a social media insignia or a symbol. So the whole time somebody's name could be like Joseph, but when they get into the chat, their name could be like Shark or something like that. So the whole time you're talking to Joseph, you get a good rapport with Joseph, you could get into the private chat where you don't know who these people are behind these insignias, and they could be completely throwing you under the bus. So the pot for the winner is up to $100,000. They have to complete certain challenges to get the pot up to that. Right now, it's nowhere near that. I think it's like $49,000 or something. But it's really interesting because people start forming alliances and you see them talking in private, and, you know, a guy might really like a girl and latch on to her like Chris has. I don't want to ruin anything if you guys plan on watching it, but it's very interesting because you do not know who these people are behind those insignias, behind those symbols, behind those avatars. You can guess, right? So when you get into the chat, there are things you could say that would incriminate yourself. If somebody says, I think that Joseph should go home today, right? Because you have to, like, so let me finish explaining the show, I guess. So basically, yeah, you live in this house, you co-mingle. So then you get into this anonymous chat, right? You pick your insignia. I think they've done it like three times now. You pick your insignia or your symbol or avatar or whatever. And you basically start to get really messy in the chat. So you talk about who should go home. Now, after that, they have a vote. So the vote is for you, who you want to go home. Whoever gets a vote is quote unquote at risk. So then after the vote, whoever gets a vote, they're at risk of going home. So then they have a test or a quiz or whatever you want to call it, where you guess who each insignia is, who it is behind each insignia. Whoever gets the most right, they are the anonymous. They get to vote whoever's at risk off the show. If you're safe, you're safe. If you got no votes, then you got no votes. But if you are the anonymous and there's a person at risk that you want to get out of there, you can get them out of there. So it's really interesting. So they're down now to, I want to say, like 8 people. And it's gotten really messy because people are starting to figure out who, you know, other avatars are. There was one guy that was really political that just got sent home. He was, you know, seemingly rubbing elbows with everybody on the show. You know, it's getting very interesting. I would recommend it even if you don't like reality shows. This is not your typical reality show per se. They're kind of, in a way, they are simulating what it is to be like on social media and then right in front of the person you were talking to, like right after that, seconds after. Very interesting show. I would definitely recommend it. Those are pretty much the things on my mind. I've been watching WNBA playoffs. Don't want to talk too much about that. Probably just going to do a overall review of that eventually. I do know that they are into the semifinals and the Liberty are up on the Aces, the defending champs, right now, 2 games to zip. So now they're going back on Friday to Vegas. And then the Lynx and the Sun are tied 1-1. So on Friday, they're going to go back to Connecticut. So going to leave that there. And I'll talk a little bit about that later, but I am watching the playoffs. Let's get into the meat of the matter, pause, of why we're really here today. The Mr. McMahon documentary. I have some thoughts. So, for those of you who have been living under a rock, Netflix recently released a Vince McMahon documentary, a 6-part miniseries of basically a documentary on Mr. McMahon, Vince McMahon, billionaire wrestling promoter. For those of you who didn't watch wrestling, WWE, WWF when you were a kid, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to say this at the onset. I don't think this documentary was for me. For people like me that have watched wrestling, paid attention to a lot of the out of the ring stuff. This was not for me. This was not for us. There were a lot of things missing that wrestling fans, hardcore wrestling fans, wanted to know, wanted to hear about. As far as spoilers, if you haven't watched it by now, sorry. You know, you can skip over this part. I'm going to talk about some stuff. I'll go over it. So I'm going to just do a short summary of every episode. They open up in the first episode, they open up basically showing all of the talking heads that are going to be on the show. Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin, Bret Hart, Cody Rhodes, Undertaker, Linda McMahon, Vince's wife, Stephanie, his daughter, Shane McMahon, his son, Triple H, his son-in-law, Hulk Hogan, Eric Bischoff, Trish Stratus, The Rock, Vince himself, obviously, and John Cena was also in there. One person I didn't write down was Teddy Atlas. Teddy Atlas was another one. I'll be honest, I don't really know why he was a talking head. Not that he was bad, he was actually pretty entertaining, but when you think of legendary WWF, WWE wrestlers, Teddy Atlas doesn't necessarily shoot to mind. I don't know. So they began this process. They began interviewing in 2021. They go over what happened. Essentially, the last interview, it was supposed to be sometime in 2022. After the allegations came out, Vince canceled that last interview. They claim they have over 100 hours of interviews. Essentially, what happened was the board got an anonymous tip from somebody about this alleged abuse. Hush money, all that sort of stuff, and then an anonymous tip went to Wall Street Journal, and then they released their entire article about it. So after they went over that, I gotta say, man, Brett really likes the taste of his own dick. The way he was, just self-filleting himself. Look, I'm a fan of Bret Hart's work in the ring, but man, I was an artist. Yeah, okay, bro, you were an artist. We get it. You don't have to hype yourself up. There are plenty of people that already do it for you. So remove your dick from your own mouth. I mean, seriously. They set the stage for what the business really is about. They explained it. This was for casuals. I'm going to just say it. It was for casuals. This was not for a hardcore wrestling fan. This is not for a person that watches wrestling. Still, this is not for a person to watch wrestling past, their childhood. This was for somebody who stopped watching wrestling when they were a really little kid or never watched wrestling. So they explained the ins and outs of the wrestling business a little bit. They go into the fact Vince didn't meet his father until he was 12. He was abused living in a trailer park with his mother and stepfather. They also hint at some incest later on. But, he met Linda at 16. She was 13. Essentially, he met his father at 12. As I said, his father brought him in to, run one of the territories, not territories, one of the areas in Bangor, Maine. So once he actually did a pretty good job of that. In 1976, Vince became an announcer for the Hamburg PA TV that Vince Sr. was running. So They skip over a lot of stuff. They basically skip to the point where Vince Sr. was going to sell the company. They make it seem as if Vince Sr. was just going to sell the company because he wanted to get out of the wrestling business. He was actually going to pass away. You know, there were a lot of details here that they just sort of skated past. He was originally going to sell to Gorilla Monsoon. Vince obviously made a better claim for it. So essentially Vince Sr. said, all right, well, I'm going to have you make me payments in increments, and if you miss any one of those payments, I will take my company back and sell it to Gorilla Monsoon. That's basically what is asserted here. You know, so his father did, in a way, I guess you could say, make him earn it if you want to, you know, give Vince McMahon a pat on the back. But really what it was Vince was paying his father back with the funds that he had already made with the company and would continue to make. So he really didn't build anything from the ground up per se. You know, they get into the whole territory situation, Vince infiltrating territories. He basically starts running shows and territories for those of you who don't know what territories were. So before wrestling was national, there were territories. So every territory would be a region or sometimes even just a state of wrestling where promoters would run wrestling shows within that territory. And, you know, promoters would trade talent back and forth. Wrestlers could freely go from here to there. You know, they'd go from Oregon, Texas, and, you know, Georgia, Tennessee, etc., etc. And Vince basically broke the unwritten rule that you aren't supposed to, you know, infiltrate these territories and run shows in somebody else's territory. He would do that, and then because he had more money than them, he would offer more money to their talent and eventually buy out their talent. That's the shortest summary I could possibly give. So when he started doing this, you know, something that they left out was the fact that they're trying to make it out to be sort of like Vince started to take, you know, eat up these territories and he just, you know, had success in all those regions. He didn't. He did not have success in a lot of those regions until he got Hulk Hogan. He got Hulk Hogan from the AWA, Vern Gagne. He essentially poached him from Vern Gagne. And Hogan goes, he starts working for Vince. Vince initially wanted Dusty Rhodes as the champ, but Dusty did not see this national TV vision, this national promotion vision that Vince did, so he declined. Vince ended up getting Hulk Hogan, who had built this entire Hulkamania persona in AWA, just basically brought it over to WWE. He put the belt on Iron Sheik, kind of like a transitional champ to eventually get the belt onto Hulk Hogan, yada, yada, yada. I'm not going to go through this whole thing. I'm trying to make this as short as possible, but also as detailed as possible at the same time. Yeah. Essentially, prior to that, Senior had fired Hogan because he said, hey, I don't want you in movies. If you go do Rocky III, you're fired, basically. And Hogan said, okay, well, I'm going to do Rocky III anyway. And then, you know, Vince Jr. brought him back. So 84, he beat Sheik for the championship. You know, they were doing a whole foreign villain thing with Sheik. And, Backlund is funny. They skated over this. Bob Backlund was champ for 2,135 days, right? Like, it's kind of funny that they just kind of skated past that. There's a lot of things they did not put enough detail into. Yeah. So, Vince starts to get in contact, I guess, through Lou Albano. Lou Albano had met Cyndi Lauper, famous pop star from back then on MTV, met her on a plane. So then Vince is starting to really carve his niche in the mainstream, you know, area of entertainment by bringing these, you know, these celebrities on. And this is when he starts to come up with the idea of WrestleMania. They get into a couple of things that happen throughout that where, you know, they're advertising for WrestleMania. And of course, they, with more publicity, you have more risk of, you know, bad publicity, because John Stossel, who was a famous interviewer back then, media personality, he essentially was trying to, you know, he acted like he wanted to come and find out more about WWF, when in reality he wanted to come and kind of, you know, create an expose of the business. He was asserting that, you know, the business is fake and blah, 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 blah. Vince kind of, in so many words, said he wishes that somebody would take care of Stossel. David Schultz, one of the big heels from back then, big heels in that territory, basically smacked Stossel twice. It caused a lawsuit. Richard Belzer, you know, Hogan went on Belzer's show. All this was in a matter of months, mind you, leading up to WrestleMania, doing press for WrestleMania. Hogan put Belzer in a front face lock. Belzer falls after he's choked out, bangs his head. That's another lawsuit. So, there's that whole thing. Now, nobody really knows how close WWE was to shutting down, but, you know, Vince basically made it clear that this was a make or break situation for WWF at that point. If WrestleMania did not succeed, they were going to be hamstrung financially because they financed and mortgaged everything they had, all the money they had to pay for WrestleMania. So the episode basically ends with WrestleMania, you know, exceeded expectations, companies growing, and they kind of leave on a cliffhanger with the steroid trial. So now episode two starts with, you know, essentially the first note I took and jotted down was Hogan, who I cannot stand, not just because he's a racist, but also because he's an egomaniac. I also forgot the fact that he's a liar, a habitual liar. He did tell the truth here, where he admitted to being a snitch, because Jesse Ventura, former governor of Minneapolis, or Minnesota rather, I'm sorry, he was trying to form a union among the wrestlers. And prior to Mania 2, they would have essentially held up Vince for more money, insurance, etc., etc. Hogan essentially snitched and it was nixed. Vince gets into how Mania 2 was a disaster, a lot of technical issues. They tried to have it in three different places because Starrcade did the same thing early that year. They tried to have Mania in Chicago, New York, and LA all at the same time. There wasn't really any appeal to that besides the fact that he just wanted to kind of, you know, one-up WCW, or I guess at the time that would have been, WCW, I think. Oh, no, it wasn't WCW till like 91, so, I guess you could say NWA. He tried to upset NWA. And, upstage NWA. So then Mania 3, of course, he comes up with the idea that it's going to be Hogan and Andre. This is where a lot of the lies came. You know, Shoemaker, who is supposed, or Shoemaker, whatever his name is, supposed to be some wrestling historian. He has no idea what he's talking about. He said that Andre was a touring heel. That's false. Andre was a touring babyface. A lot of the lies that WWF told at the time were just promotional lies, saying Andre had never lost, Hogan and Andre had never met, all those sorts of things. You know, that was promotion, but for a so-called historian to get facts wrong, not only here, but in the Andre documentary, pretty embarrassing. It just shows that Bill Simmons needs to vet who he has as a wrestling historian and people in his team. He needs to vet them a bit better. But then again, he also didn't care because it's for casuals who weren't going to seek out the actual correct information. One of the main things that bothered me about this. You know, like I said, Hogan's a liar. He's just fake. He's absolutely insufferable to listen to. He's trying to create the perception, essentially, that he didn't know whether Andre was going to, you know, lie down for him and take the pin and take the three, and, you know, if he was going to become champ. He claims he does not know whether this was actually going to happen or not. I think it's more so along the lines of Andre kind of playing games with him and Vince kind of encouraging Andre to make it seem like he did not know whether he was actually going to do business or not. I don't think this was a situation where he actually did not know. They had Dave Meltzer on here. I can't stand Dave Meltzer. Dave Meltzer, he's one of these people. He's like a critic. He's a so-called historian. He's one of these people who talks about wrestling like he's a genius, but he's really not. He's just had a newsletter, a hack newsletter, for years. They had him on here as a talking head. As a historian, I guess he's okay, but once he starts giving his editorialized opinion about the business of wrestling, he loses me. And he's always been a person that's just annoyed me, because in my business, the music business, there are also people like this, critics who believe that they know better than people who actually are in the business, and they don't. They're people who either failed at the business or never worked in the business. That's what critics are. Movie critics, food critics, they're all the same. They're failures within that business. Anyway, he keeps trying to debate the number. Oh, it's a number. They're lying about, you know, what the numbers were as far as attendance, blah, blah, blah. Whatever. He's the face of couch potato Monday morning quarterback culture. It plagues today's society big time, and he's one of the main culprits of it. Anyway, so Hogan was the face of the company, superhero babyface. He wanted to leave and do movies. Vince convinced him to stay and basically said, I will do a movie as long as it keeps you here. So it kept Hogan from Hollywood for a little bit. They fast forward to Mania 6. They completely skip over Macho Man. There wasn't even a mention of Macho Man in this. It's very weird. Macho Man hasn't been mentioned by WWE for years. And that Stephanie story is very, very interesting. I won't get into that right now. So I skip over a lot of stuff. So Mania 6 was when they say that the popularity for Hulk Hogan started to dip. Ultimate Warrior was who they had primed as the next, you know, person to come over and take over Hulk Hogan's spot as the top babyface. Or good guy, for those of you who don't watch wrestling. You know, they skip over that. So Warrior beats Hogan, and then they say, Warrior flamed out, so they had to pivot back to Hogan. It's really not what happened. Warrior won. They never really pivoted away from Hogan. Hogan legitimately left and then came back and beat Yokozuna after Yokozuna had beat Bret at WrestleMania 9, I believe. So he came back and as the Glory Hog basically did that entire, just sham of a post-match angle, I guess you'd call it. Sergeant Slaughter, he was a big time babyface. He was a big time good guy, big time hero as sort of this G.I. Joe type character, for the, I don't remember what WrestleMania this was. WrestleMania 8. They basically did this angle where they turned him into a Iraqi sympathizer. They blame the fact that it was so close to home as far as the Iraqi war going on, the Gulf War going on. That's why that this flamed out. No, it flamed out because nobody cared. They couldn't draw. They were going to do LA Coliseum. They ended up doing some very small arena. It flamed out. They basically comped a lot of tickets and didn't sell out. It was a huge failure. So then they get to the steroid trial. So 1991, George Zahorian, they had a doctor that was in the locker room. He was, you know, selling guys steroids. Vince decides that he comes with the bright idea of he's going to start the, I think it was called the World Bodybuilding Federation. That flamed out. So as soon as this steroid trial came around, he decided to fold the World Bodybuilding Federation, which I don't know why he came up with that in the first place. Nobody cares about bodybuilding for the most part. It's not really a mainstream thing. Hogan denied using steroids like an idiot, because that's what he is. He's an idiot. And then this is where they introduce Phil Mushnick. I can't stand this guy. He hates wrestling. He tries to pin everything bad in society on wrestling. He's one of these virtue signaling, self-serving, you know, editorializing journalists that basically goes, you know, he runs based off controversy. And he had it out for wrestling his entire time as, you know, journalist or whatever he fancies himself. You know, so then they get into the whole situation where Vince, he made Snuka's murder allegations go away. I guess Jimmy Snuka, who was a big time baby face at one point with WWE, Vince, a lot of people believe, made the murder of Snuka's girlfriend go away, essentially disappear, because he needed Snuka for business. Snuka, it's believed, killed his girlfriend in that hotel room. We don't know for sure, but they get into this, you know, these scandals. You know, Mel Phillips, the Ring Boy situation, where, you know, they used to hire young kids to, you know, put the ring up and things of that nature. Mel Phillips and Terry Garvin were two of the people who would basically assert their power, assert their dominance against these kids and say, hey, you're not going to work here if you don't do these sexual favors for me, yada, yada, yada. Pat Patterson was involved in that, a lot of people believe, but Vince has separated Pat from that. Of course, with Pat being homosexual, a lot of people have sort of tried to attribute that to Pat, but that wasn't the case. You know, Bruce Prichard also denies it. Then we have the Rita Chatterton scandal, where she claims that she was raped by Vince in a limousine, and he offered her, you know, $1 million contract as a ref if she does sexual favors. She claims, you know, Vince says that it was a mutual relationship, it was a mutual interest. They go over a lot of these, you know, a lot of these scandals. So then, you know, Hogan, quote unquote, retired. They basically finished the episode with him going off to, you know, testify against Vince, or so they thought, in the steroid trial. Episode 3. They start this episode by talking, I think this one was called Screwjob. They start this one talking about the Wendy Richter screwjob. Essentially, she wanted more money. This sort of sets the stage for what Vince did to Brett with the screwjob situation. He had Moolah, Fabulous Moolah. A lot of people consider her definitely one of the highest drawing women wrestlers of all time, but one of the pioneers of women's wrestling. He had Fabulous Moolah come in and under a mask, basically pin Wendy Richter, and she kicked out, but essentially the ref was supposed to count to three regardless, screw Wendy Richter out of the belt so Vince could take his belt back, because he wanted the belt to change hands. So they set the stage with that whole thing, sort of showing that Vince would do anything for the business. He says, I would do anything for the business, anything for my business. You know, so then we get to the steroid trial. Hogan backs Vincent's steroid trial, even though he's headed to WCW, already at WCW, after he said, I'd never run against you, I'd never sign with another company, blah, 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 blah. He ended up backing up Vince because they gave him immunity, and he claimed he was going to testify against Vince, and he didn't. All right, so Vince gets a not guilty, he gets a not guilty verdict. So WWF is struggling, obviously, because they can't use these big, jacked-up wrestlers like they used to. He thinks that Bret Hart is the best candidate to lead them into the next generation, completely change how they display their wrestling product. Because Bret was clean-cut, he wouldn't have to worry about, you know, Bret getting into any trouble, that sort of thing. On the other side was WCW, who Hogan signed with. Ted Turner was not afraid to, spend money. He had Lex Luger. Lex Luger was a person that he signed. Vince just was not paying these wrestlers enough at the time. Eric Bischoff took over as the, you know, head producer. He was head of wrestling around this time. He spearheaded the competition against WWF because he had the bright idea of being different than them. Nash and Hall left. They talked about the curtain call. Shawn Michaels asked Vince to do the curtain call, but in a way that I guess Vince didn't really understand what was going on. Vince gave him the blessing. And, they went out there and essentially good guys and bad guys hugged in the ring, sort of like a theater Broadway type thing. And it broke kayfabe, which they also get into explaining what kayfabe is, which basically is when you are in the act of portraying a character, you portray that character 24/7 as to not make people believe that it's not real. That's essentially kayfabe. I'm just trying to summarize this as best as possible. So they get into this whole wrestling war, WCW and WWF. Vince sued WCW, basically crawling into the fetal position because WCW was doing the same thing that he was to the territories, which was, you know, stealing people's ideas, stealing people's talent, and utilizing them, honestly, in ways that were a bit better than him. They lead all the way up to Brett's contract being up. Brett had creative control. Some people call it reasonable creative control. Other people call it creative control in general. Screwjob happens. Him and Shawn hate each other. Shawn Michaels said he wouldn't lose the belt. They didn't go over a lot of stuff with the screwjob either. For a production that was supposed to be, you know, somewhat a casual production, they didn't go over the screwjob enough. But, you know, all the ins and outs of the screwjob you could find on YouTube or books. But basically Brett was leaving. Brett's contract was up. Vince couldn't honor the contract that he originally signed Brett to. Brett went and signed with WCW. He was, you know, about to head out. They could not agree on how Brett was going to lose the belt because he didn't want to lose to Shawn because he hated Shawn. Anyway, so Vince screws him over in that match, and boom, Shawn gets the belt. Brett goes off to WCW, bitter because he got screwed out of the belt in his hometown, yada, yada, yada. In the locker room, Vince and Brett get into an altercation that a lot of folks can't agree on how it happened. Brett says it was an uppercut. You know, Pritchard said it was a temple shot. You know, Vince had a black eye. You don't know what to believe. Either way, this spawned the Vince McMahon character. That's pretty much how I left off my notes for episode 3. Episode 4. So basically, they start out with Vince hanging out with Dr. Jerry Graham, a notable wrestler, when he was a kid. This was basically his biggest inspiration, where he got a lot of his heel persona from. Some people say that's where he got his driving from, because, you know, Jerry Graham was known to drive like a maniac. They get into the whole Attitude Era. Shawn Michaels stuffed his shorts, and they claim this was the start of the Attitude Era, even though Shawn should have been punished. This was the edge that he was looking for to turn their product around. Austin and D-Generation X lead the Attitude Era, the hottest time in the history of wrestling, in my opinion, into the late 90s, and, you know, WWF has a resurgence. Austin, they get into how Steve Austin benefited from Triple H's punishment because of the fact that Shawn was a champ, so he couldn't get punished. Nash and Hall left, so they couldn't get punished. Triple H was punished. He was supposed to originally win the King of the Ring, which was a major tournament back then, which was basically, you know, a tournament of the mid-card wrestlers that would essentially elevate one of them into the title picture. Austin won that, so he had the advantage that Triple H would have had initially. So Bischoff eventually gets complacent. He thinks that this run of dominance against WWF, which was 83 weeks straight on TV, beating them in ratings, he thought that was going to go on forever. When he saw that they got Tyson, that essentially turned the tide of things. They got Mike Tyson for WrestleMania, and he did the whole angle with Shawn Michaels, D-Generation X, and Mike Tyson. So then Vince gets into this whole spiel where he feeds off heat. He craved it. He reveled in it. He tries to separate Mr. McMahon, the character, from Vince. Nobody agrees with him. Everybody basically says that all the talking heads in the show, I should say, agree that Vince McMahon is basically just, or Mr. McMahon, rather, is just Vince McMahon turned up, with the volume turned up. It's essentially just a, you know, an over-accentuated version of him. Phil Muschnick keeps whining, complaining about them targeting kids, even though they clearly weren't targeting kids. It was not a kid show at that time. I can't stand that guy. So then they get into the whole Owen scandal. This was kind of a tough part to watch. For those of you who don't know, Owen Hart, Bret Hart's brother, died in an accident where he was on a, I don't even say a zip line, but like, you know, one of those holsters where they drop you down on a rope or a cord, and you come down from the ceiling. He basically, the rope snapped. He broke his neck on the ropes and died right there in the ring. They have a whole conversation about whether they should have continued the show that night, and Vince does not regret anything. He says he would continue the show every time if he could go back and do that decision again. Just a really tough time. I hated this part. I was too young to really understand it. But, you know, the more I've looked into the Owen Hart tragedy, it's really sad. Especially considering the fact that the last few years of his life and his career were away from his brother. So that was tragic. And then they basically end that episode on a cliffhanger, leading into the Chris Benoit tragedy. So, one after the other. Paul Heyman starts episode 5 talking about Vince. And this is a common theme that I noticed pretty much right away. Vince was such a control freak because he wanted to push his entire childhood so far out of his head, so far, you know, out of his purview that, you know, he could never have to think about those things again. He just buried himself in his work to escape his childhood trials and tribulations. They start to get into conversations and the interview portions with Stephanie and Shane, Vince's kids. I can't imagine how tough it was for them during their childhood to get into this business, see who their father was, and be held to the standards that I'm sure he held them to. You know, Shane started out as a crony for Vince, trying to earn his stripes. Stephanie graduated and started as, you know, an on-camera talent later after that. They had the whole Test situation where she was supposed to marry Test. Triple H suggested that, you know, he drug her, which this is crazy to think about in 2024, drug her, take her through a drive-thru wedding or drive-thru, I'm like blanking on the name of this, a drive-thru where you can get married, basically, and, you know, marry her. That was the angle. So, you know, Stephanie becomes a heel, and off-screen, Vince was trying to push Stephanie and Triple H together in real life as a couple. They kind of skip over a lot of stuff here as far as China was dating Triple H at the time. That wasn't really mentioned. So that was a huge thing. You know, Triple H was allegedly cheating on China with Stephanie, so that was a whole thing. China was a wrestler back then. She started out in DX with Triple H, dated him for a few years. And like I said, when Stephanie and her got together, when Stephanie and Triple H rather got together, he was apparently cheating on China. China ends up leaving the company. So yeah, Stephanie becomes a heel. They become an on-screen couple, even though they were married in real life as well. Vince wanted to broadcast their wedding, and he didn't get his way. So what did he do? He said, okay, well, I'm going to face Stephanie in a cage match. I mean, this is ridiculous. I'm going to face Stephanie in, is there a street? I don't even remember at this point. A street fight or a cage match. Some match with a lot of weapons where she can get hurt. Linda said if she gets hurt, anything happens to her leading up to her wedding, I'm filing for divorce. Who knows if she was super serious or not. Sable, the most popular women's wrestler during that time, filed a sexual assault lawsuit. Vince says he doesn't remember. All he remembers is that she came back to work for him. Selective memory, obviously. They go over this Playboy article with Vince talking about having affairs during his marriage with Linda. Also talks about being abused and raped as a kid by his mother. 2001... WWF goes public. A lot of, you know, it's opened a lot of potential revenue streams that all failed. They had restaurants. They had all sorts of stuff that just failed. A lot of different ventures. He buys WCW. He negotiated a simulcast into the deal for WCW where he could broadcast WCW TV, WWF TV that same night. I think they paid roughly $4 million for it, which was pretty cheap for WCW, the entire library. And then he had to renegotiate all the, they didn't go over this stuff, but renegotiate all the contracts with the talent that he wanted to bring in. A lot of the main stars, Goldberg, Nash, Hall, Flair, they did not initially come in. So, they kind of skip over the entire alliance angle, but that was a flop. So it was supposed to be ECW and WCW versus WWF. Turned out to be a flop because a lot of the big stars they did not have. Vince starts XFL. It was a complete flop. If you want to know anything about XFL, just look it up. It was a football league that he tried to run opposition to NFL. He tried to do a lot of things like storylines and things that were fake that sports fans don't want to see in their football product. He tried to change the rules to the football, the game of football, or his league rather, contrary to what the rules were in NFL. It just was a complete flop. At this point, they got into the World Wildlife Fund, who had the trademark for WWF long before WWF World Wrestling Federation did, so he lost that case. They had to rebrand to WWE. They also talk about how people who left the company come back to the company, as well as Vince working with people that he didn't necessarily like Eric Bischoff. He hired him. They talked about that, but then they also got into the fact that Austin left, Rock left. At the time, creatively, there weren't a lot of interesting things that they were doing for these guys, so they went and found other things to do. Rock went to Hollywood, Austin took his ball and went home. Cena comes, he's the next big star. You know, Vince says, I want ruthless aggression, and, you know, that was a whole, basically the catchphrase of this era. Where they want to find new stars. They also get into asking Stephanie if she ever told her father no for any of the angles that he suggested. She said yes, but she wouldn't elaborate. And then elaborate. And then here comes Vince and says, my character was going to impregnate Stephanie. It's just like, dude, really? You know, so many of these allegations that come out, while they do sound a bit far-fetched, at the same time they sound less far-fetched when you find out that he pitched an angle on his TV show to impregnate Stephanie. Just insane. Vince talks about how he was harder on his kids as a way to seemingly go as far away from, you know, the nepotism claims as possible. An example of this is Shane wanted to buy UFC. Vince didn't want to buy it. He couldn't control the characters. He couldn't control the outcomes. He couldn't control the merchandise. He couldn't control any of that. So he didn't think that buying the UFC was a good idea. Of course, in retrospect, the UFC is a part of TKO now, which is a joint company with WWE and UFC. So the egg is kind of on his face for that. There was one time Vince got into an argument with Shane about a creative idea or business venture that Shane had. Vince essentially challenged him, said, hey, you know, here's a knife, stab me in the back, or stab me and take me out, kill me the way that I had to essentially do my father to push him out of the business so I could take over myself. You know, Paul Heyman told that story. It was a very contentious argument, and then that ended up with Shane leaving the company. Vince ends this episode essentially by advising everyone to not bring their family into the business. And this leads into episode 6, leaving a cliffhanger for the allegations. So, episode 6, the 6th and final episode, Vince starts out by talking about how he has multiple brains moving at the same time. They're all vastly different. When asked what one of the brains was thinking, he said something having a lot of fun involving sex. This guy. They get into the whole Donald Trump thing. Donald Trump came and did an angle. He'd always been a fan and supporter of WWF and a good friend of Vince McMahon. They get into that whole thing. Chris Benoit. For those of you who don't know, Chris Benoit killed... He was a former wrestler. He was a WWF wrestler, one of the greatest of all time. He killed his wife, he killed his son, and he killed himself. In his home. In 2007. He was a big topic of discussion at that time because, you know, brain issues. They studied his brain. Figured out he had a brain of like a 60-something year old. Condition-wise, doesn't want to get into the whole CTE situation. Chris Nowinski, a former wrestler for WWF, went and took it upon himself to get a group of scientists and study Chris Benoit's brain. And this is where all of the studies, you know, about CTE really took off, because Vince didn't really believe in it. And they had also did studies with the NFL, and everybody basically was denying his group of scientists, along with Chris Nowinski himself, about their studies and claims of how concussions have an impact on the human brain. Vince basically summed up the Chris Benoit situation as, Chris went nuts. It happens in every walk of life. It's hard for me to strictly pin it on CTE. I'll just leave it at that. During this point, Hogan, Vince McMahon, and Austin all basically debunked CTE, or attempted to. Austin flat out says he doesn't believe in it. I lean more towards it existing and there being legitimacy to the studies. In the wake of this, WWE banned chair shots to the head. I still hate it because, it had gotten to the point where guys were starting to get their hands up and kind of block the chair shots. I just think it looks very dumb to hit somebody with the corner of a chair in their gut and then hit them in the back. If you're going to swing a chair, just swing a chair. Here comes Mushnick again. He comes off as so unlikable. He just lays the entire plight of the wrestling business at Vince's feet. Like I said, I think he's a self-appointed martyr, a fake one that is, virtue signaling, you know, self-absorbed guy about a lot of this stuff. I think he hates pro wrestling, and he's using that as a vehicle to come after Vince McMahon. You know, then they talk about how Undertaker had a concussion in the match against Brock at WrestleMania 30, where he was taken to the hospital, and Vince actually followed him to the hospital to make sure he was okay, because Undertaker was in such a bad condition. Vince basically says that it wasn't a concussion. He calls it psychological shock. Like, come on, dude. It was a concussion. They talk about WWE moving to TVPG with the company going public that allows them to get more sponsors, higher price sponsors, more, you know, joint ventures once again. I hate TVPG. I think they went too far to the PG side of marketing their product pretty much like strictly towards kids at a certain point. Another note I wrote was, gotta love how interviewers are asking Meltzer opinions and questions about the status of things within WWE as if he had any idea what was going on. Dude's an idiot, a hack, and someone who's never worked in the business. Once again, I don't get it. Why do people value this guy's opinion so much? He's never worked in the wrestling business. He has no idea what he's talking about. I don't get it. Anyway, WrestleMania 32... This was another moment that was interesting and pretty emotional. Basically, Shane talks about how all he ever wanted was his father's respect at WrestleMania 32. Against The Undertaker, he jumped off the cell and went through and landed basically through an announce table. 20 feet he fell. Absolutely insane. He also talked about the match against Kurt Angle, where Kurt Angle tried to throw him through the glass structure, the glass stage that they had set up at King of the Ring, and he couldn't get him through. He kept trying. Shane was falling on his head. Finally, Angle got him through. But all these things that he did for Vince's acceptance. And, you know, like you said, after the match, all you ever wanted was his respect. Vince's respect, it hit home for a lot of reasons with me because, you know, my father passed away when I was younger, but, you know, up to that point, like, I felt like I didn't really have my dad's respect, per se. Like, I felt like I was in the process of having it, but not really, because I was just kind of a silly kid that was doing stupid stuff, and he was trying to show me that, you know, I had to grow up a bit sooner than I wanted to, and that part hit home for me, I'm not gonna lie. So then they also talk about how Shane was not crude enough to take over the company. Stephanie was a lot more like her father than Shane was, which you can kind of see. Shane just was not a jerk. He was not a jerk to people, was not a rude person, was not a crude businessman. But Stephanie is a crude businesswoman, which kind of leads me to my theory of the fact that I think she was the anonymous tip, or I think she was behind the anonymous tip about these allegations. I think she wanted to push her father out. Why do I think that? Because as soon as he came back and forced his way back in, guess what she did? She retired. She left. She left the company. So prior to the allegations, Vince said he never saw himself retiring. He would basically work until the day he died. June 2022, the allegations came. Janelle Grant, she had a long list of allegations about hush money that was not paid. Getting hired to the company for basically a phony position to work at the company. He abused her, did a lot of things. I won't get into the graphic, gory details of the allegations, but, you know, that whole thing came out. He essentially tried to fan the flames during that time, but he also canceled the interviews, or the last interview, rather, for this documentary. You know, it was $12 million to four different women over the course of 16 years and hush money for, you know, misconduct. Vince retired. Stephanie came out on TV and led a thank you Vince chant. It was odd at the time. Cody said, Cody Rhodes, current WWE champion, said at the time that it was very chaotic, which obviously for obvious reasons. The next note I wrote was far too much Meltzer in this episode. Far too much. Get this idiot off my screen. So then, Vince forces way back in. Stephanie resigned. And it really makes me think that she was the whistleblower. They brought Pritchard back a couple years later after he interviewed, and he said that he essentially thought that this was a hit piece on Vince, which he's kind of felt that way about a lot of things. He's been Vince's right-hand man for a long time. You know, he's very loyal to Vince. He talked about Vince essentially saving his wife's life and giving him the money that he needed for her surgery and all those sorts of things. I'm sure that Vince does have some things that he's done in his life that are very, you know, kind, very generous, but no doubt he's a troubled man. That's the best way I can put it. He's a troubled man. There was also the conflict of Vince not reporting the Ashley Massaro rape. She eventually committed suicide, unfortunately. There's a lot of stuff here. You know, I fall somewhere in the middle with what I believe versus what I don't believe. What I can say is that WWE is currently thriving without Vince. With Triple H at the helm, they are hotter than, you know, damn near ever as a product. I respect Vince's obsession with the business. I respect his appetite and work ethic for the business. But, you know, the allegations are damning. He'll have his day in court. It is not for me to really say whether Janelle Grant is telling the truth about a lot of this stuff or not. You know, we'll find out. But that is my review of the Vince McMahon documentary. Like I said, I tried to skate through it as fast as possible. And that is also our episode for today. So, like I asked you before, please like, share, and subscribe. And I will be back in the week with a lot more, you know, videos for you guys. And, yeah, take care. Peace.